they're roughly the same as they were last year, but worldwide they are still much higher than they were a year ago. Now, inventories are being drawn down. There's no question about that. And this recent OPEC agreement should help in that regard. But we are in a vulnerable situation relative to these inventories. The second thing that we have to be concerned about is the Iran-Iraq conflict. Iraq absolutely refuses to go along with the OPEC accord and is producing way beyond their quotas today. It's for them literally a matter of survival, primarily because, in their view, they are on the defensive relative to the war between themselves and Iran. Iraq also has planned a pipeline. In fact, it's not planned. It's in the stages of early construction right now, that will be in addition to the current line going to the Red Sea. And when that line comes on stream, which is expected in about 18 months, that will add roughly another 1.5 million barrels per day to the production for Iraq. Also under construction right now is another line across Turkey to the Mediterranean, which is scheduled for completion very shortly here. That will add another 500,000 barrels per day. And we have no doubts that Iraq will continue to produce as much as they can. And this is a problem, will be an increasing problem, that OPEC as a whole will have to address. The third factor that I would like to lay out revolves around the fact that within the OPEC agreement itself, there are certain factors that are excluded. And the one factor that we have to be concerned about is refined products. Now, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others are increasing their output of refined products, and refined products are not subject to the OPEC accord. The rate of increase in exports from the Persian Gulf area for refined products within the last 90 days has increased dramatically by 50%. Now, what this does, of course, is put more pressure on refined products sold by other firms around the world. That, in turn, puts pressure on prices, which, in turn, is passed along to crude oil and acts as a damper on the upward price movement in that direction. The fourth thing that I'd like to address is the confidence problem, as I call it. The longer the OPEC accord holds, the more strain it is going to come under. And I'd like to delve into, just for a second here, cartels. Right now you have a situation whereby OPEC is a cartel-type organization. And if you look at the history of cartels, you will see that they go through periods of success and failure. And with those periods, you see rising prices and falling prices. The situation within OPEC is such that you have low-cost producers. In the case of Saudi Arabia, for example, they can produce that oil for less than $1 a barrel, selling the end product at a relatively high price. And when you have that spread there, that large profit margin, that acts as an incentive for certain members to cheat. And if you're the first in line, you will gain. Now, the problem, of course, is that when that happens, everybody jumps in and things collapse. But if you look at our history here, when it comes to cartels, you will see periods of success and periods of failure. Right now, it's obvious that OPEC is a period of success, and we hope that they will continue. But the downside risks are tremendous, and there's something that we cannot ignore. Now, I'd like to move on to the state's specific price projections. As you all know, our 30% case is a little over $14 a barrel, and our mean case is a little over $15 per barrel. And perhaps you have heard in the last few days several other oil analysts asserting that this is unduly conservative. I don't think so. These oil analysts themselves have used price ranging from $11 to $20. And looking at what other states are doing, There are some that are right down there with us. But in our particular situation, I think that it behooves us to adopt a conservative approach because, number one, we don't have the diversified economic base that other states do. And two, we are, as you are well aware, about 80% dependent on oil revenues, an extremely volatile commodity. Now, I'd like to move on to the last package here, that Section 5, and it's titled The Oil Price Volatility in the State's Economy, just to bring home the fact that we are dealing with a volatile commodity here. If you look at the third page of that packet, titled Actual and Projected Crude Oil Prices, you can see that from 1970 through 1986, which is actual data, prices for Saudi crude, for ANS crude on the Gulf Coast, and ANS crude on the West Coast, there's been a tremendous variation. And that situation of volatility is something that the state has to confront head on. Now, in that regard, let me just do a little summary here, and then I'm going to turn it over to Chuck. This economy is characterized by, A, the fact that we depend on oil revenues for approximately 80% of our revenue, by, B, the fact that the state does not have a diversified economic base, and by, C, the fact that this oil money flows through state government and supports your loan programs, your municipal revenue sharing programs, educational programs, much of our employment, and a good part of our private business activities. As far as the oil picture is concerned, as I've indicated earlier, cartels go through periods of success and failure, and prices rise and fall. And that is an extremely volatile situation to have to deal with. As far as forecasters are concerned, you and I both know, and Chuck and I in particular, that we can change our opinions overnight, depending on what's happening to the politics and to the fundamentals of supply and demand. And just to give you a little bit of information here, in March, Mr. Horton of Standard was advocating that, or suggesting that perhaps a $15 per barrel oil was the so-called norm. Now he is asserting that perhaps it's $18. And this information is attached. But he is also asserting that they are prepared for oil prices of $10 if necessary. They're prepared to handle that. I think that the state has to adopt some sort of a budget reserve type fund that you've been discussing here in order to iron out the peaks and valleys. By doing so, then we can have steady economic growth. We can perhaps provide predictable state service levels, and we can continue to maintain our credit rating. You can put 360 economists in a room, and usually they will point in 360 different directions. But there's one area that they do agree on, and that is, as a government entity, or if you are managing the government, you want to strive to attain the goal of steady economic growth. And I think that the only way we're ever going to be able to do that, given the volatility of oil prices, is to develop some type of a budget reserve fund. Now, there's one other issue here that I'd like to turn over to Chuck, because I don't think that the public has really gained an appreciation of that issue. That has to do with differentiation. People talk about $18 and $19 barrel oil. But when they talk about that, they're usually referring to, or the analysts are, oil that is either West Texas Intermediate or some other type of oil. And we have to take into consideration the fact that there are differences in ANS crude versus other types of oil. And with that, I'll turn this over to Chuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. With all the publicity Price is getting these days in the state, and I suppose in all oil states, I thought I'd confine my remarks to fairly technical, straightforward explanation of just what our method is for forecasting price and how we got the number we have. The first thing I want to stress is that our forecast is based on a range of prices. We don't sit in a room and decide what the price of oil is going to be over the next month, year, 20 years, and then decide what the production number is, multiply the two together and times the tax factors to give you a revenue number. We look at a range of numbers. Our forecast is a true forecast in the sense that we look at a wide range of possible outcomes and we weight them. So I can in good conscience tell you that we looked at $10 oil. We looked at the possibility of 20, 30, 15. Where it comes out in terms of the number that we present to you is something from the middle of the distribution, and we've chosen to use the 30% case. Okay. Anyway, anybody can say, well, the price of oil is going to be this, and you were saying on average it was going to be that. We'll take the difference, multiply it by 130 million, and give you a new forecast. We can do that. We don't propose to do that today. I'm just going to go through kind of what we've done. I should say at the outset that in my own personal opinion, our forecast in June is conservative, and given what's happened in OPEC, it's probably more conservative given what's happened than it was before. But other than that, let me just go through for you quite briefly the technically how we go about doing the forecast. The price volatility issue is the key to why we use a range and why we attempt to analyze a range. And there's really two sources of price volatility. One of the major pieces of volatility is associated with OPEC behavior. You've got to try to come up with some way of judging, and there's OPEC watchers all over the world that attempt to evaluate just exactly what are those guys going to do next, because it's not totally incorrect to say the price of oil in the future will be whatever the Saudis want it to be. Certain individual players in the market have enough power that they can very dramatically orient the direction of the market. So what we're talking about there is, where is the market price set? You hear people saying, well, it's an $18 a barrel market right now. What is that $18? Well, that's kind of a peg that OPEC sort of used as a guideline price. It's a starting price. That's one source of variation, the variation in price based on OPEC behavior. The other source of the volatility is affected by market, the functioning of the market. And in the case of oil, there's seasonal consumption trends. There are world events, wars, embargoes, cartel cheating, changing tax environments, the possibility of import fees, windfall profits, a lot of those kind of issues. There are just a very large number of things that can happen in the market which can cause price variability. Okay, to give you some idea exactly how we deal with this, first of all, we use the Delphi sort of technique to establish what we think this $18 or bench or whatever you want to call it. We call it the marker crude, and specifically we ask the members of the price committee to establish for us a set of scenarios for what they think Saudi medium, the comparable crude, the North Slope crude, will sell for over time. Okay. The second thing we try to establish is what's the variability around that, and to do that we for guidance look to what has it done in the past. So in section number four, what I have is, it's the last three tables if you've got that section. The third from the last table, it illustrates the differential or the difference between what you would pay for a barrel of Saudi Arabian crude oil at the U.S. Gulf and what the ANS producers reported on their tax returns as the amount that they sold the oil for. Okay, well, you'll notice if you look at that the numbers are all over the board from month to month. There's an incredible amount of variation. In fact, if you look at the following page, there's a graph. It shows that on a monthly basis, that differential between our crude oil and the benchmark crude oil can vary as much as $3 a barrel. It can vary quite widely. Okay, so let's look at the data that was available when we put together the forecast. That was data through February. If you take the average of that differential through February, you'll see on the right-hand column the number that the average was minus 265. If you take that number down to the bottom of the page, this will give you some idea of where our average U.S. Gulf price came from. Believe it or not, our Delphi session forecasted a price of $17 for Saudi Arabian crude oil. That was the result of our June forecast. You take that $17 and you add on the $1.55 to move that oil to the U.S. Gulf, and you come up with a landed Saudi medium U.S. Gulf marker price of $18.55. What we did was, strictly speaking, to try to make an unbiased estimate of what this differential was going to be, we simply took the average of the data we had, which turned out to be $2.65, a negative $2.65. Add that in, and there's the number that we used to characterize our forecast, $15.90 on the Gulf. Now, I didn't illustrate it here, but if you want to take it one step further, only 40% of our oil was sold at the U.S. Gulf. The other 60% is sold on the West Coast. I didn't put down the West Coast differential. The West Coast differential is a result of the fact that because North Slope crude oil cannot be exported, we've thrown the West Coast oil market into a glut. Ever since North Slope crude came into the market, crude oil in the United States is about as cheap as anywhere in the world. In fact, it's probably the cheapest that I know of, other than perhaps a subsidized crude run in OPEC producing countries. Anyway, the discount between the Gulf and the West, it runs anywhere up to $2, and in some cases it has been as much as $3 a barrel. So what does that mean? That means that when we tell you that the price we used was $14.50 a barrel, you've got to understand that that averages in very low, much low prices on the West Coast along with the Gulf Coast prices. So the real point I'm trying to make is that when you hear people comparing what our expert says as opposed to revenue, remember that when somebody says the price of oil, you better be darn sure what oil they're talking about and what market they're selling it in, because just as this data that I've illustrated in this table shows, there's a wide variation in what one price translates into as far as North Slope crude oil prices. And I think this dovetails fairly well with Vince's point about our economy's reliance on oil. These things might seem like something that a trader might be interested in, or someone who buys and sells crude oil who takes advantage of, well, it's a dollar out of alignment with the market here. But to Alaska, a dollar a barrel means quite a bit of revenue. And so it's one of the key features of what we do, and that is we attempt to deal with the volatility and the variance of price, and we enter a range. And I think you have to look at the context of our forecast. Anytime you're looking at our revenue forecast, the number that we present to you is based on an accumulation of information looking at a wide array. And we don't sit down and like I say, I think oil is going to be about this, production will be about this, and generate a forecast. We try to give you an assessment of the risk associated with the price and the variation associated. And that concludes my remarks, and I don't know if Vince has anything else to add, but I guess we want to set questions now. Or thank you.
Mr. Wright. Questions? Representative Rieger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had three questions going through your presentation. One was on production. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on what kind of pipeline throughput your production estimate would average out to on a daily basis.
Yes. In fact, I don't know if you have a copy of our latest the June forecast, but on page 15, there's 15 through 17, there are tables which illustrate our assumption about production. The total Alaska column on 15 does include about 5 million barrels a year out of Cook Inlet. Well, actually 15 million in closer to 15 to 10 million in the first few years. But basically, we're looking at rates of throughput in the neighborhood of 1.88 million barrels a day. And I should point out to you that we, in fact, are somewhat conservative with respect to the MER Prudhoe Bay. I believe we have a slight downturn beginning in 1989, whereas the producing companies have indicated to us, the field operators, both ARCO and Standard, that in fact they are confident that they can keep production at the MER at least through the first half of 89. So we do have a little extra caution incorporated in the downturn assumptions. On the other hand, I should add, we may be somewhat more optimistic than the companies when it comes to the speed of the decline. We're using something around something a little less than 10% a year once decline sets in. And of course, it is possible. Well, let me put it this way. The production engineers tell us that the longer they keep Prudhoe Bay at the MER, it's robbing Peter to pay Paul in terms of the distribution of production over time. You eventually see production fall off much more rapidly the more you accelerate production.
Now, I noticed on page 13 there was a statement that the total actual North Slope production was averaging 1.822 million barrels a day, and I tried to multiply that out, and I came out to about the number that you showed for simulated production. I was wondering, is it the 1.82 that you're basing it on or 1.87?
Which was this for fiscal 88?
Fiscal 88.
That could be. I see that. I don't have my calculator, so I guess if you took 694 minus 11, if you took 683 and divided that by 365, that would tell you exactly what our daily rate is. I apologize for not making that conversion. And Vince, do you have that memo? I know where we have the answer to this, Representative Rieger. It's on page 39. Mean TAPS throughput 88 is 1.87. I guess I said 1.88.
Okay, 1.87. That's. And the only last question I had on that was, what is the actual throughput of the pipeline, you know, these days?
Well, it varies, and I apologize for not having the. I have the statistics here through March, April. But it was very high in January and February. Prudhoe Bay output was running close to 1.6 million barrels a day. In fact, in January, production averaged this is Prudhoe Bay. I'll just give you this as a starter. Averaged 163. In February, it averaged 1495. And in March, it was, once again, I don't have the conversion here, 59,290,301 barrels went through during the month of March. But I can certainly, you know, provide an indication. The point is it is somewhat variable, and that it just between January and February, it fluctuated nearly 150,000 barrels a day on average. Generally speaking, they will attempt to produce the fields at the highest rate possible over the early periods of the year to ensure, particularly in the case of Prudhoe Bay, that they will average the MER over the year. And they always try to allow for a closing of Valdez for weather and other unexpected stoppages in pipeline throughput. So generally speaking, you will see higher production rates early in the year, and then whatever they have to make up at the end to balance, they'll do in like December. But the throughput of the pipeline is variable. I think that's probably the best way of putting it.
You don't think that these days it's running above 2 million barrels a day, do you?
We know that they can produce it above 2 million barrels a day. Physically, it is apparently possible to do that. But you'd probably want to talk to somebody from the pipeline itself to find out the physical limitations on producing at throughput rates that high for any period of time.
I just wondered if it was actually running in there.
Not according to the data I have through April, but anyway, that's basically the data I have.
On that question, is the old rule of thumb about $150 million per dollar in oil price still an accurate rule of thumb in the range that we are now?
I don't know. We've got a tax rate change on one of the biggest fields that might have changed that rule slightly.
So, what would you say is the rule of thumb?
For all intents and purposes, that rule still is an acceptable one of these, I would say.
So when we try to put a number on, you know, there's an exhibit in here somewhere that shows us being $250 million out on an accounting basis, not on a cash basis. That's like $1.65 per barrel out.
If you want to go with a net of permanent fund contribution, you'd use $130 million for every dollar. It might change that a little bit, but
that's in the high. It's more like $1.80.
That would give you a rule of thumb sort of approach to that, right?
And that's above. What is the average price on the 30th percentile? Is that 14?
1408.
1408. So you'd add you'd be pushing in $16 is really a balanced budget. Oil,
using price. That approach, that's what it would suggest.
Just trying to back in, if you're not right. saying that's right or wrong,
yeah,
that's
right.
what it would have to be. And the posted prices, there's only one, Ohio's the only company that posts
right.
prices, and they're at what for Gulf Coast and West Coast?
1825, unless they changed it today. There were a lot of rumors floating around that they were poised to make another announcement, but as far as we know, that's their official selling price.
That's West Coast or Gulf?
Gulf Coast.
Both 1825 Gulf and then lower?
$17.25, a dollar discount for a West Coast sale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pritchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a number of the same questions on production. I was just kind of curious as why there was apparently disagreement going on. I've attended several public meetings in which oil industry spokesmen as well as members of the legislature have said that the revenue forecast is underestimated throughput by as much as 100,000 barrels per day, and that last week it was reported that the pipeline was running at over 2 billion, and that might account for as much as a $100 million difference in forecast over the course of a year. And it seems on the surface that it wouldn't have been, it's not the same political arena in terms of forecasting price as throughput, and it seems that the companies would have a fairly clear idea of their production, anticipated production over the next year. I realize it fluctuates because of pipe, the transportation factors and cleaning
right.
and breakdowns, and but you would think it'd be closer than
right. And let me address that question from the point of view of an organization that doesn't have any petroleum engineers or geologists on the staff. What that means is we have to rely significantly on our communication with the operators of the field and also the Department of Natural Resources. Basically, for us, that means dealing with the public affairs people, with the companies. And we are people on my staff aren't in very close communication. Unfortunately, we find ourselves in a situation then of getting information on a somewhat lagged basis, which means that before last March, when ARCO went before the financial community in New York and announced that they were going to hold the MER at 1.5 through 89, we got mixed signals from the companies on when and how long that production was going to be held up at that level. That's just a fact of life for us. Because we've had to deal with the situation from the perspective of communications rather than having any actual data, we don't have a reservoir simulation model, that sort of thing. We found ourselves in a catch-up posture as far as revising our production numbers upward. If you follow our forecast at all, or if you had, and there were a number of people in the financial community who called in September, December, and March asking, why have you so radically increased your production assumptions? And I said, well, that's simply because information is becoming made available to us from the companies. And there's reasons for this, too. I don't necessarily feel that it's a conspiracy in a sense. I mean, first of all, nobody knew how successful the water flood was going to be. There's always a risk, and the production engineers tend to be extremely conservative about their coming in with production numbers that are too high. They want to be too low so they can come in and say, we exceeded our production goals. That's a fact of life. The miscible gas injection, which turned out to be successful on a pilot project, was expanded to certain areas of the field. Now that's expected to contribute to ultimate recovery by 100 million barrels. These kinds of factors are that plus the inherent, I think, conservative posture of the producers themselves with respect to going out on a limb and announcing to the world we're going to produce and then not being able to deliver. They tend to be conservative, so we tend to be conservative. But when things happen, when suddenly phase three of Kuparuk goes in, for instance, and by golly, they're producing almost 300,000 barrels a day out of a field where phase three was supposed to bring production up to 250 when it was initially proposed, and the planning served as a basis for our assumptions, you find yourself adding oil, and we'll continue to. That's the beauty of doing a quarterly updates in our forecast allows us to incorporate this information. It's unfortunate that sometimes we have to make adjustments in a fairly radical way, so you do. It just adds, I realize it adds, it's just another dimension which adds to the volatility of the forecast. If anything, though, I think you can take some comfort in the fact that we have been conservative on production as well as price, in the sense that if there, and it goes along with the 30% case, if there's any possibility that the Department of Revenue is wrong, it's going to be that they didn't forecast enough revenue. And that should be some comfort that you, and I think that perhaps was kind of where the gentleman who spoke before was speaking, in terms of the way it's perceived insofar as the state's financial posture, is that they're using revenue numbers which are conservative. We use a 30% case, which basically, and that's something that I don't want to run too long here, but also want to stress that the 30% case, that does not just represent a so-called 30% price. That represents an extra hedge on volume, too, because that's the 30% from the output distribution. That's the, there's a distribution of possible revenues. That means we took low prices and low volumes and high prices. That also is incorporates a production hedge, if you want to look at it that way. Now, we've never reported it that way, because it's a little easier to set production at some, you know, so this was the mean production, and then load all the variability in revenue onto price, which is, if you look at the thing that we, you know, the transmittal that we letter and the information we provide to you on a quarterly basis, that's what we've done.
So. I just had one other question on another topic. I was a little bit confused by your analysis of West Coast market for oil, and you talked about 60% going to this glutted market, and sometimes the price is marked down up to $3 a barrel. But yet in 88, you're predicting a difference of ANS price of $1.19 differential between Gulf Coast and West Coast. And what, over the last couple of years, I know Bob Maynard and others have briefed members of this committee and the Oil and Gas Committee about what that means relative to the price we get. It's still my understanding, with that type of differential, that backing the added transportation costs out, or including them, I guess you might say, the difference between West Coast and Gulf Coast, that we are actually making more money.
Oh yeah, I didn't mean to introduce any confusion on that point of view. Yes, that is in fact correct, that the lower transportation cost to the Gulf Coast more than wipes out the lower sales price. What I wanted to, the reason I brought it up was, is that people talk about, yeah, you're using, it's $18 oil, and you're using 14. Well, part of the reason why the average number that we have is 14 is that we're including in that average oil that has to be sold in a market where it gets maybe a dollar less than the Gulf Coast. But you're exactly right. On a netback basis at the wellhead, which of course is really what we're really interested in terms of revenue, sales on the West Coast are preferred. I mean, that's the whole issue with the royalty sales, for sure.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The most recent forecast was done before the recent OPEC meeting. And I'm wondering to what extent the favorable events of the last few days would affect your view of the June forecast. If you were making it today, would it be a little bit higher? How do these recent events affect your view of the mid-June forecast?
Well, it's inescapable that they would have had a significant impact on the Delphi panel in establishing that market. Vince says that 360 economists all point in a different direction, but they all head for the same exit or entrance, depending on who's got the bell on. And when the price of oil is 18, every single economist that you can find will say, yeah, that's the right price, that's what it's going to be. And we, as a group, that's why we try not to, I was trying to stress that if what it would have really, what it would really do is it would have changed the way we would have weighted the likely outcome over the year as to whether or not 15 was more likely than 18 or 18 was more likely than 20. So, I mean, it would have shifted that distribution. And it's bound to happen. There are events that will happen between now and August, which will influence the forecast number that we update in the estimate for FY 87 or 88 on at that time too. And this, I must admit, this was a very significant event, a very significant event. It was the best that the state could have hoped for in terms of OPEC behavior. But that's, it's no guarantee of anything, but it's a hell of a lot better than if they'd adjourned with no agreement at all.
Thank you. Could you quantify it any more?
Well, like I say, I mean, I could say, yeah, well, we said 15.90. Gee, if we use the differential of only $1.30, which is what the differential between ANS and Saudi has averaged since June. Why the difference between $1.32 and $2.65 is $1.30. So yeah, there's a revenues would be up based on an increase of price in $1.30. But whether or not that would, you know, that would be a, you know, that would be a scenario, and anybody can generate those kinds of scenarios. And I would be very reluctant to try to give you anything more than my own example there as to what the potential impact is. I would really be much more comfortable, you know, making a forecast rather than scenarios, because, like I say, anybody can do that. Anyone that, yeah, right.
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions about the price at which cash flow becomes a problem. I don't know if you gentlemen are the correct people to ask this of. Mr. Barker might be able to respond also, but at what actual dollar per barrel would we run into a cash flow problem similar to the one that we confronted earlier this year when we were right there on the edge of an absolute inability to meet the state's obligations?
I think we're going to have to defer to Mr. Barker.
Mr. Barker, would you stand and rise and respond to that, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We haven't tried to work backwards and figure what price would eliminate any cash flow. We have a cash flow based on the March. On that basis, we will not have. We will have a cash. Well, if we had made the deposit that's proposed of the $250 million to the budget reserve fund early in this fiscal year, we would have a cash flow problem. Assuming the executive branch had discretion, actually, that problem.
Based on a $14, we would run into
based,
that.
Based on the current revenue price.
$14.08.
So, Mr. Chairman, that leads to my next question. In analyzing House Bill 329, the governor's proposal, in Section 2, it provides that the balancing of the books would occur some period of months after the end of the next fiscal year. And Mary Halloran opened the discussion this evening by saying that the intent of this legislation was so that we could pay the state's bills. And I'm wondering how we reconcile the ability to pay the state's bills should we fall into an unexpected situation. As you all are aware, the bill that the House passed would provide the ability to address cash flow should that become a problem. How are you reconciling the taking these $250 out and in essence increasing the deficit to $500 million using the conservative price?
Mr. Barker?
Mr. Chairman, as I indicated, the executive would have to be conservative in making by cushion or surplus fund the cash off.
Can I continue?
Yes.
The Section 4 of the bill provides that the appropriation would have an immediate effective date. I guess, you know, as I would read it, it would say immediately upon the effective date of the Act, the $250 is appropriated. And could you elaborate on your view of the difference between a transfer and an appropriation?
Well, yes, again, there is a difference. The appropriation authorization, which I reported as a receipt.
If we.
Commissioner, did you want to respond to Representative Brown on that point?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name's Hugh Malone, and just generally to elaborate a little bit, the rate at which an appropriation is expended or paid out depends on the purpose of the appropriation in almost every case, unless it's a direct flat grant to go out at a specific time. And so generally speaking, the rate of drawdown or transfer on an authorization that's provided or directions provided by the legislature and the executive branch would depend normally on the purpose of that appropriation, and so we're assuming that that normal latitude would exist within the scope of that appropriation unless the legislature directed otherwise.
Is there any scenario that you see under which we would, under the proposed House bill, have an actual cash flow or inability to pay the state's obligations? At what price would we have that ability if we did have the, or assuming that you would exercise caution or restraint in actually making the transfers of the 250?
Again, Mr. Chairman, we haven't worked that out, that sort of. The general, I think, tenor of this appropriation bill is that it's a backstop, and revenue is due to better, which is hope to face those delays in making any transfers. They'll have to be analyzed on.
It's been stated by several members of the administration that the House version of Senate Bill 157 is not an acceptable proposal because it does not balance the state's books, and it. You know, I'm having some difficulty comprehending that line of reasoning when it's standard practice and presumably will continue in the future that there would be a supplemental appropriations bill considered in the next session. It's not going to occur for 14, 16 months.
Chairman, I might just reiterate Johnson's basic point he was making reflects on the management of state affairs outside. There is always the potential that once you start down that road of going into your budget deficit basis, not go as well as planned, face the next year with doing further unbalancing of your budget. Actually would not have the ability to go back retroactively supplemental or some other mechanism and there are situations that would lead to that, but it raises that possibility and a question about just how the state does the
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, another way of looking at it is that we started this fiscal year, this is the first day of the fiscal year with a deficit, for the fiscal year ended, at least the difference between our recurring revenues and our expenditures. And I guess the real question is here, how long do we want to keep this up? And what we're saying is, we don't want to keep it up anymore.
It seems to me that the proposal in House Bill 329 increases the deficit and decreases the access factor that Mr. Johnson also spoke to, which is, under the House-passed version of this, the governor would, in fact, have a safety net of up to $500 million to meet cash flow without further action of the legislature, and that what's proposed here in this bill does, in fact, increase the likelihood of a deficit and of an actual cash flow shortage.
Chairman, does it slip off the 200? Does exacerbate cash problem. Again, background for this legislation is the hope that oil revenues will rise and will not be a cash problem. And therefore be able to benefit in the future having replenished the reserve fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barker, it's very hard to see that you say the oil prices will rise when we're hearing it's $14.07. Do you have a scale on which, if you said it was $16 per barrel on the amount of money the petroleum revenue would be, would you say it would be approximately $1.97 billion if it stayed at this average price of $16 per barrel for the whole year? My reason behind this is because this particular body passed a total budget that's without capital, approximately $1.93 billion. And we're working on capital at this particular time. But in order for us to have a balanced budget, if the oil revenues continue at $16 per barrel, that, if you go along with me, would bring in approximately in petroleum revenues of $1.97 billion. Non-petroleum revenues to the state of Alaska next year is an amount of $300 million. So if you add those two figures together, taking what obligations that we had passed, the 1.93 plus the $250 million, then we would have sufficient funds to take care of this particular idea. But if you're saying to us that it's going to stay at $14.08 a barrel, then we will have a deficit situation where we will have to go into the permanent fund earnings to take care of this deficit. That correct? Do you have an average on $16 per barrel? If it stayed there, what the petroleum revenues would be?
Mr. Chairman, you can take that rough rule of thumb, and with an extra $2, another $260 million, that brings you up to 1.9 in total revenues.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, I just want to see if I heard what you just said on regarding 329. You indicated that that the state of Alaska, and I believe the commission said, did not want to create a situation and put you in a deficit. But by the passage of 329, as Representative Brown said, we are creating a deficit unless, as you said, the oil prices stay up. So I don't see how I don't see how we're achieving what the department and what the administration wants by the passage of this bill, unless, as we said, as was said, the oil prices stay up. And also, I'm still not convinced that 157 isn't a better vehicle, in that that's a better backstop than what we have here. And maybe I missed some of the discussion, and I apologize if that's the case.
But. Is there any more for revenue, so I can just bring up Ms. Halloran and Mr. Barker here, so we can. But one of the things that we need to look at also is the impact of what we do in the permanent fund also at the same time. Thank you, gentlemen. I would like you to be available. I am not going to do any passage of any piece of legislation tonight, but I will be coming back at 11 a.m. after the caucus in the House there. So we'd like to continue this particular debate on what piece of legislation we're going to pass. Or if we look at a conference committee with Senate Bill 157, which is faster on the other side versus what we're doing tonight. Okay. Ms. Heller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have caucus at
9:00. The representatives, there's about 3 inches lower than that one. I wasn't ready for it. Thanks, Lou. A lot of points have been already raised and that I wanted to respond to and go into in depth. And first of all, we're not here tonight advocating use of the permanent fund earnings as our first choice for resolving the deficit. As this administration has said consistently from the beginning, our first choice was to not give a tax break to the oil industry, to reinstate an individual income tax, and to raise motor fuel tax. Now, the House has been cooperative in two of those three measures, but there's the other body. So we're here because of that situation. It's a choice between using the permanent fund earnings or taking money from the oil industry, and the Senate has narrowed that choice to one source. Second, I think Representative Rieger, Frank, and Gall all raised a question that I thought was very important, which was basically you were asking, does it make a difference if this money is left in the permanent fund earnings account or moved to the budget reserve fund? And I understand why that's of concern to people. I think it does make a difference. If you look in your packet, we gave everybody two sheets. One that's a base case for the permanent fund earnings, what happens to the earnings in the future if we make absolutely no changes, and the second, a case, what happens if we make what we would call the maximum draw on those earnings. I would turn your attention first to the base case. If you look at the base case, what you'll find is that over the next 5 years, by FY93, the earnings reserve account disappears. It goes to zero. It goes to zero because of the current structure of the statutes regarding the distribution of income from that account. First priority goes to dividends. Second priority goes to inflation proofing. Only the leftover amount stays in the earnings reserve fund. The projections of the permanent fund corporation indicate that over the next 5 years, somewhere in that time period, that money goes away. It goes away, you know, basically about $100 million a year over the next 5 years. That's why, from the administration's perspective, it's important that the budget reserve fund serve as the state's savings account rather than relying on the earnings reserve fund, because we don't see that fund as being permanent unless the legislature wants to come to grips with the impact of the dividends on both inflation proofing, the fund's principal, and the other uses of the earnings. Wait, I don't think that you're ready to come to grips with that at this point. It's a question that's going to have to be resolved in the future. That's obvious. But so that's the reason why we're advocating replenishing the budget reserve fund as opposed to just leaving things alone and using the earnings fund if an emergency comes up in the future. Representative Larson also asked some questions about the financial rating agencies. I do need to note that some of you are probably already aware that Standard & Poor will be here at the end of the month to conduct a major and in-depth evaluation of the state's financial situation and how it's handling its revenues and deficit. We are concerned that at that point we are able to tell them that we have the determination and the resolve to balance the state's books, to, in fact, go forth with everything on an even basis from here into the future. Now, to speak more particularly to the impacts of the permanent fund on the permanent fund of any potential draw, I think we could go through the base case. And Jack Farnelli, would you join me? Could you provide the members of the committee with copies of your memo to me this afternoon? Jack Fragnoli is my senior analyst who deals with the uses of the permanent fund, and the memo summarizes in written form what I would speak to you about verbally here, and which I'm sure you would see as you looked at the two things anyway, but just to make sure that it's easy. There is no denying that we're assuming in our comparison case what we would call the worst possible draw. We're not assuming any rise in oil revenues. We're not assuming that the legislature comes to grips with raising other sources of revenues between now and the end of fiscal year 88. To the extent that either one of those things happen, that there's some other source of recurring revenue established, or that oil prices do in fact rise, the impacts in the permanent fund would be less than presented to you in this paper. But assuming the worst, so to speak, there is an impact over time on the principal of the fund. You can see as page 2 of the memo states that it's close to $500 million by the end of fiscal year 91, and a cumulative impact of over $1 billion. That's due to the fact that you lose earnings. You lose power to protect inflation proofing and the principal. I think the other thing that's probably of most interest to most individuals in Alaska is the impact on the dividends. The actual impact on the dividends per capita is minor. It's almost insignificant. There would be no impact on the dividends for FY87. There's no impact on the dividends for FY88. It only comes into play for the dividends of the FY89 when the per capita difference in dividends is $10. It's not from my perspective at least, a major impact when you're still talking about giving people $841. That impact does accumulate to a larger sum over time, but even there, over a significant period of time, it's about $60 over about a 5 or 6 year period of time. Jack, any particulars you'd like to add?
No, basically the main effect is on principal, which, as Mary has said, is about $438 million over the first 5 years, and that's a direct result of the draw. Should the permanent fund's earnings be different from the assumptions used here, which are the same earnings and inflation rates used by the Permanent Fund Corporation? In particular, if the real earnings of the fund should be greater than what is shown here, especially in the out years, you see a 3% real rate of return. Should it be more in conformity with what we've seen in the last few years, or at least greater than 3%, the effects of the draw will actually be greater than what is shown here, because you'll have a greater real earnings foregone.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mary, the governor has been, in my recollection, steadfastly in support of inflation-proofing the permanent fund. Is that true?
Correct.
Well, it seems that that's a little inconsistent with, and I'm not condemning, this situation, but it seems inconsistent to be steadfastly in favor of inflation-proofing the fund, and at the same time willing to use these earnings, these excess earnings, so-called excess earnings, that really are going to be eaten away in the next 5 years through inflation-proofing, because there's going to be a call on them to make up for inflation-proofing.
I think it's important to point out that the way the statute functions, that what eats away at everything else is the dividends, not the inflation proofing. The dividends capture more and more of the total earnings of the permanent fund, and then inflation proofing is secondary.
I thought that the earnings reserve, or the old fund that we put in there, the $1 billion that we put in there last year, would have eventually been eaten up, because the real rate of return is projected to be only 3% over time, whereas the nominal rate is projected to be 9%, and half a 9 is 4.5%, and that exceeds the real rate of return. And so you would wind up, you're not fully inflation proofing the fund according to current statute, based upon the assumptions, and so that any excess in the fund earning reserve gets eaten up through full inflation proofing over time. I think that's been the permanent fund board's and staff's position over the last year or more, the last few years. And so it seems what we're really doing is, if we do take $500 million from the earnings reserve, we're really taking away funds that would be used for inflation proofing in the future. And I was under the impression that your projections show that being used for inflation proofing over the next 5 years.
I think the instant clause is, it really is going to augment or supplement the inflation proofing that's not otherwise available from regular annual earnings. But what really drives that is the fact, and the reason there is not enough for full inflation proofing, is because of the priority given to the dividend. One leads to another. I mean, to attribute the causality, I mean, I don't know.
But 50% goes to the, by current statute, goes to the dividends. Actually, it's the 21% of the
five-year rolling average.
And that's a fixed amount. The only amount that varies is the amount that's dependent upon the rate of inflation. If the rate of inflation is low, as it has been, you build up an excess reserve. If the rate of inflation is high and the real rate of return is low, then you're going to wind up needing to call on that reserve, that earnings reserve. And that is what we're talking about doing away with, under this proposed legislation. And that's why I think it's inconsistent to be proposing to do away with that and spend it, and at the same time be a steadfast supporter of inflation proofing. I think they're inconsistent.
There is no denying that any time you make, under the current structure of the permanent fund, that any time you make a draw on the earnings, you are going to, in fact, speed up the day when we have an inflation proofing shortfall. That is a simple mathematical fact at the moment. As I said, we take this approach very reluctantly, but given the fact that both the administration and the legislature have found it themselves unable to lower the level of spending to any lower than we've been able to do it this year, and not find other sources of revenue, we find ourselves, this is the only way out to balance the books, pay off the deficit. Now, to the extent that oil revenues rise, Section 2 of the bill does not go into effect. That's the safe stop. This is a safe stop measure. This is a backstop measure. That's, we're all hopeful that OPEC hangs together and oil revenues are up, but we don't want to count on it.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. A moment ago, when you were addressing the issue of why it's important to make the transfer to the budget reserve, I understood you to say that the primary reason is because the permanent fund earnings reserve is not permanent and eventually it's going to be eaten up. I wonder then, what is the administration's objection to the proposal passed by the House, House Bill 166, which would transfer at the end of the year the entire surplus that might exist in the general fund and thereby create an even larger budget reserve than proposed in House Bill 329.
We would not oppose the enactment of House Bill 166. And that would be, from our perspective, frosting on the cake. The problem is, at the moment, from our projections, there is no surplus at the end of fiscal year 88. If there turns out to be a surplus at the end of fiscal year 88, we would be happy to have it deposited into the budget reserve fund, particularly because the governor does not want to see an increase in the state spending level over the current fiscal year as enacted by the legislature.
Continue.
If you have are in general agreement with the proposal in 166, does that extend to the timing of the appropriation? I'm having a problem here when we're talking about taking money so that the money going into the budget reserve is a higher call than money coming out of the permanent fund. It seems to me that that's what the effect of House Bill 329 is. It sets aside the budget reserve. It says we're not going to get into that. But if we, you know, do have a shortage, we're going to pull from the permanent fund. Whereas the approach proposed by the House would not do that. It would only put this money into the budget reserve if there is, in fact, a surplus without drawing on the permanent fund. Do I misunderstand, or is that your understanding?
I guess the short answer to that is we don't want to bet on the come in terms of having a budget reserve fund. We want to have a budget reserve fund. And
but at the expense of the permanent fund, as you've just pointed out.
That is the governor's position.
Representative Pushaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question on your most recent calculation of the 87-88 deficit. You're projecting $250 million now, and that, of course, would have to be adjusted upward to 8.3 based on today's actions. But that is down from your June updated forecast of 317. In my reading of your materials, and I have forgotten it, it seemed to me that one of your assumptions in that 317 was that that did not assume issuance of bonds for the student loan, which would, of course, would result in savings of $40 million. Could this 250 or 258 now be further reduced $40 million with the issuance of student loan bonds?
Yes, it could be reduced to if student loan bonding is issued. It also could be increased based on the salary negotiations underway with the labor unions, because we did not include the impact of Section 22 of House Bill 75. And so those were two things that are just major variables. They both happen to equal about $40 million in their maximum. So we just kind of, that's one goes up, the other goes down, potentially. Yet there are other variables, obviously.
If the administration, of course, the governor signed both bills.
And yes, he did.
Is there any problem that you know of now with the issuance of student loan bonds sometime in FY88?
None that I'm aware of.
The administration isn't opposing the issuance of those bonds, are they?
We're not opposing the issuance of bonds, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Looking at this particular bill, House Bill number 329, would the administration be opposed to adding language that allows you to borrow the money from the permanent fund reserves versus the way it is written at this particular time?
And assume that money would be repaid at a later date from
excess
oil revenues or something.
Or windfalls?
Like windfalls. No, sir.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple of questions on cash balances, and they might be for Milt. I'm not sure, but I'll just ask them and see if we can answer. Back in the early part of the session, we kept getting almost a daily update, how much cash is in the bank. On June 30th, how much cash is in the bank?
Parker.
We had 734.
Okay. June 30th.
June 30th.
Okay, so $734 million. And can you tell, when you close the books, you give me a guess, what is the accounting, you know, what is the fund equity balance, I guess is the lingo, on June 30th that corresponds to that $734 million after you deduct all these old appropriations that maybe will be spent?
Chairman, I believe that's reflected in OMB, and which I believe about a deficit of about $2 million.
Yes.
Okay, so at the end of the fiscal year, there's a $2 million accounting deficit. So really, if I can summarize, that difference, which is $736 million, reflects old, either encumbered or unencumbered, non-lapsing appropriations. Is that a fair statement? Or is there some lapsing that would maybe make that smaller as of July 1?
Mr. Chairman, basically,
at
this represents a capital.
Right, okay. And on the, without the $250 million proposed transfer to the Budget Reserve Fund out of the General Fund, what, in that memo that you wrote in June, what was the forecast cash in the bank in June 30th, 1988? I remember it was in that memo, but I don't have it with me.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we had a forecast $196 million at the end of FY88. Cash balance, result of recent actions here, updates, that's FY88.
Okay, so how is it that you said that the $250 million transfer would throw you into a cash, running out of cash in March, if there was $300 million left at the end of the year without it?
The problem is, in looking at June 30, is that you have significant revenues coming in on severance. Go back to June 29th, the balance, cash balance, would have only been $6 million. Prior to that, there would have been further patterns with the drawdowns for another deficit.
Okay, I follow that. One last question. On the capital project reserve reduction and proposed capital projects and all, that doesn't really have an effect on anything that we just went through. That would be a... Would that essentially be like a reappropriation bill? What you're doing is finding $80 million out of that old $736 million, and that's what's freeing up the money for a capital project? Or is this other money somewhere else that you found for this proposed, the finding of money for the capital budget?
Mr. Chairman, that would basically only affect the deficit. It would not really affect our cash balance. It would affect our projections of cash balance because we baked in capital projects which are collapsed or taken. That would be a rather minor effect because we only, during the first year, 5% that may, in the main, affect just the appropriation.
The appropriation amount. So it is part of that $734
million. A small part, yes. Not $86
million. There's some other money somewhere else that you're not better off with on the books that's the source for some of that $86 million. But you can't give me a split as to what that is, roughly. You can't give me a split as to how much of that would apply to the $734 million, just in rough terms.
Again, Mr. Chairman, 25% of
okay.
that had been projected to be made probable.
Okay.
So that cash balance might...
So we... Right now, we have cash in the bank equal to about 33% of our annual budget.
That's, well, I would say that's not totally accurate in that we also have capital appropriations on the books that if you wanted to do an analysis of how much is the state obligated to spend in the future versus how much do we have in the bank, we'd have to crank in not only the $2 billion that we just have appropriated, but also the past capital project appropriations.
Okay. I understand. I'm just, you know, I'm trying to put this into context with the, you know, the frightening stories we have that we're in this terrible deficit, and I just, you know, I want to, in perspective of how much cash there is versus what the account.
No, we are not. I want to be real clear on that point. We are not claiming that we have a cash flow problem. We could have a cash flow problem, but that's not the main point of the governor's proposal.
We could, if we put $250 million into the budget reserve fund, and oil prices were at 1408 and did not go up, as everyone thinks they will, and some other things
went wrong.
Okay.
I'm going to have to let you go to the Senate shows for a little while.
Yeah.
Ripson Davis.
Thank you. I lost me on the difference between the $311 million and the $729, but I'll let that pass for now. And just ask you, on this accounting, as Chairman talked about taking that $250 million and setting it up as a borrow obligation to be repaid versus the way it's structured now, I'm just curious how that's going to fit into the accounting schematic of whether that then becomes a deficit on the balance sheet, or just what that does to our overall
with the operation of Section 2. Basically, the books are balanced no matter how much, as long as the entire deficit amount is under about $565 million, which we're not estimating that it would be that high in any case. Section 2 operates to put the deficit at zero.
Mary, I'm sorry, I don't follow you. You're saying if Section 1 was rewritten to somehow indicate that this money would be repaid with future windfalls, whatever, and then you're saying with section two that would cover any language that would have that in Section 1. Is that what you're saying?
No, maybe I should go back and ask you what your question was.
Well,
sure
my question was related to what Representative Adams said regarding the $250 million, that instead of this appropriate for the general fund, that there would be something. Language indicating that this money would be borrowed and an obligation to be repaid at some future date.
I
don't know how that works in the accounting
and what
that does to our overall deficit.
I had understood Representative Adams to be asking about Section 2, that if in fact we had to take money from the permanent fund earnings to balance the deficit, would the governor be receptive to repaying the permanent fund earnings? And the answer is yes.
Okay, so you're saying the rewrite of Section 2 would have some kind of provision that would indicate that it would be repaid.
That's correct.
And that would not change the system for balancing the books at all.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, I don't see that, but...
No, we'd have to work on the language to make it work. But I was just... asking a suggestion if the administration would go as far as a loan if we did get the money from the permanent fund earnings, and that it would be repaid if we had a windfall from our back taxes of, you know, $1.6 billion, or if the increase in revenues that we'd pay back into the reserves.
Yeah, I understand that, Mr. Adams. I guess my question is why isn't that then indicated as a deficit on the books of $250 million?
Or whatever
the amount is. Why would that, if there's an obligation to pay $250 million at some future time, why isn't that carried forward as a $250 million deficit?
I'm not sure. We'd have to think about how that could be structured.
I think it would be deficit because you're taking it from a savings account that had money in there, has more than $516 million in that particular account.
Well, it's
but
an obligation.
Is there any further questions, Representative Frank?
I guess on that, I guess everybody gets it. I assume there would be an appropriations deficit if you appropriate $250 million and take it, you know, appropriate it separate by the reserve fund, funneling it through the general fund, as it is here in Section 1, it seems as though it would be a call on the general fund, similar to the Rail Belt Energy Fund or the old Budget Reserve Fund that caused our big $800 million problem, at the beginning of last session. So, thing. I've got my life on it at this point, but it seems to make sense to me.
Representative Gull?
Chairman, just so that I understand, when we speak of borrowing, we're speaking about within the fiscal year, lest we deal with continuing appropriations or obligating future legislatures.
After, once we get to, we're done with our financial report, as this has stated, as of July 1st of 1988, after we look at it. Reading section 2 here of the bill. Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We'll be coming back this at 11 o'clock. Representative Ulmer, I will give you a few minutes. If you do have another bill, or that's fine. We'll be coming back in the morning after caucus at looking this. The other bill I have to take up real fast is House Bill number 328. It's salaries of certain state employees who are not members of the collective bargaining and provide an effective date. This particular body had passed a similar piece of legislation. That piece of legislation was House Bill number 187. I would ask the administration, Mary, I would ask you, that particular piece of legislation is in Senate Finance. We passed this piece of legislation with more things on it, geographic differential and stuff like that. I would ask that the administration, to save us time in the special session, go work with Senate Finance on this piece of legislation. And we'll look at it when it comes over to concurrent.
I asked the Department of Law about that question today, and they said that we have to amend the title because we'll have to keep it germane to governments that are doing
it. That's fine. It isn't hard to pass a resolution to do that. Thank you. If there's nothing further.